Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for joining us at Frieze New York. I'm Matthew McLean. I'm the senior editor at Frieze Studios based in London. And we're here today for Out in the Open, Sculpture in the Public Realm. This discussion has been made possible with the support of our partner Lifewater, who are the official water of Frieze and also our emerging program partner. One of the things we get to do with partners like Lifewater is work really directly with artists. So Brett Littman, who you'll hear for in a moment, is chairing a new venture called the Frieze Lifewater Sculpture Prize, which will allow an emerging artist to produce an outdoor commission that will be part of Frieze Sculpture in Rockefeller Plaza in 2020, and it's a really exciting opportunity. This builds on the success of Brett's amazing initial Frieze Sculpture in Frieze New York, which I encourage you all to see all around the Rockefeller campus, and it's on view after the fair right into the summer. So to sort of celebrate this moment of Frieze embracing sculpture in the public realm, we've invited Brett to talk with two amazing artists. We're honored to be joined by Meg Webster, who is an American artist based in New York. From her earliest exhibitions at Donald Judd's exhibition space to important shows at the Brooklyn Museum at MoMA PS1, she's proved to be one of the most vital artists working at the intersection of sculpture, nature, and public space. And Meg is joined by Pedro Reyes, a Mexican artist, who has some wonderful work here in the fair at Listen Gallery at D9. I encourage you to see them. For a New York audience, he will be particularly known for his extraordinary Democracy project with the Public Art Fund, and his work has long dealt with found objects, public space, politics, and a kind of amazing conceptual humor. So we're thrilled that they can both join us with Brett. And I'm going to hand over to Brett now. Thank you.
Thank you, Matthew. So since we're kind of on rock and roll time today and the fair is going to close at 6, we're going to jump right in. I'm going to ask Meg if she would kind of go through the slides that she's brought. I think it would give us a better context. And as soon as Meg's done, then Pedro will run through his slides. And then hopefully we'll have about 10 minutes to have a conversation about what public sculpture is and what it might mean. So Meg, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Are you hearing me? I'm not used to a microphone. This is in Denmark, a concave room for bees. The idea, of course, is that I'm planting for the bees to come. This is a cone of water in Italy, at the Panza collection. Also there, a cone of salt and mother mound. And so I've made a lot of primary forms with natural materials meant to be perceived directly by the body. A spiral of sticks. I can't see what that is. That must be the Socrates piece. No. That's planting, growing under solar panels. It was an experiment at Storm King to show that you can really get good production out of plants with using growing under solar panels. We literally could have solar panels over our whole crop system.
Meg, I'm sorry to interrupt, but do you think you're the first artist to work with solar panels? I don't know.
I don't know of anybody else. Yeah.
Yeah, I think you are.
The piece at Paula's, several pieces have been run by solar panels. This is an old piece. This is Milwaukee glass spiral, an early piece you entered into. Moss bed, another moss bed, but a flat one. Volume for laying on flat, and the growing piece at Paula's. Solar panels were driving those grow lights. This is that show at Paula's. This is a clay warped floor. That's what it was called.
Here you go.
Now it's going to be Pedro. You're up.
Thank you. Well, this is a part of this project that took place 2 years or 3 years ago, organized by Creative Time, called Democracy, which was taking the idea of the haunted house, and but about the most scary thing that there can be today, which is politics. So it was a sort of theater play, immersive theater play, that you were going through rooms. But the kind of to greet you in this building, the Public Army Terminal, where this project took place, I had this Lady Liberty as a Trojan horse. Because, you know, the Lady Liberty may be the most famous sculpture in the world, perhaps, or one of the most famous sculptures, in this, at least in New York. And then, and actually, yesterday I went to the Brooklyn Museum, where there's like a Frida Kahlo show, and she had made some sketches of how she sees the Statue of Liberty with a lot of irony, and after the World War, she pictures the Statue of Liberty holding a nuclear bomb and a bag of money. So, in my own personal take about the Statue of Liberty was a critique to foreign policy from the United States that, you know, like a, has used the name of freedom to wage war. And so that's obviously why it's a Trojan horse. I thought that, you know, like it would like kind of offend a lot of people to do this. But instead, you know, like everyone was very cheerful doing selfies next to it. And, you know, like it's interesting to talk about the sculpture in the public realm, because oftentimes you may think that you may be pushing the boundaries of what is, you know, like acceptable, and people just like don't feel so much shock as you thought. But what else? I don't know. Next, I have to do it myself. This is a piece that Brett he has chose to install at the Rockefeller Center. And there's probably another one, yeah. So it's stone carving in volcanic stone, and it's an eye coming out of a mouth, and the opposite, which is a thumb coming out of an eyelid. And it really is not sourced on anything. It was like a kind of a product of my imagination. Perhaps my imagination was altered.
By what?
You know, like, but I wanted to precisely convey this idea of synesthesia or organolepsis. You know, like a kind of this sort of fantastic elements that are found in mythology. And in obviously very heavily influenced by pre-Columbian sculpture, which had another standards of beauty. So that's why these are the Olmec heads from this 3,000-year-old civilization was obsessed with the jaguar lips. So, you know, that's where this shape of lips come from.
Pedro, can I ask, I know that you've talked to Jodorowsky, and you know, you've thought a lot about alchemy. I mean, these reminded me somehow of El Topo, or some kind of coming out of Holy Mountain, some odd objects. Do you think that that's something that might have been an undercurrent?
Yeah, well, the idea of I mean, it's somewhat kind of an obvious picture that, you know, like an obvious image that I don't know why it doesn't exist more. You know, like I think that an eye coming out of a mouth should be like something that perhaps should be like a more common symbol. My mom asked me, what does it mean? And I had to make something up. So, you know, like I told, well, you know, like it means that you have to have vision to what you say, or to see what you where your words go, etc. But you know, like in reality, I think that the meaning is in this case is something that obviously, as any symbol, is something that has to be, the content has to be provided by the viewer, no? In the sense that if you explain a symbol, then it ceases to have mystery, you know? Like you have to allow for an image to capture the imagination and then let someone kind of figure it out, no?
Have you ever gone to the Art Brut Museum in Switzerland? You know, because the logo for that museum is a sun with a tongue coming out. Oh. So it reminded me a little bit of the tongue coming out of the eyeball, in
well,
a way.
Also, you have, for instance, like for instance, in Fluxus, the icon that was used for Fluxus was this kind of a tongue, like a sun with a tongue that is part of the solar rock, the calendar. From the Aztec world, and that is like this kind of fantastic creatures that are present, you know, like obviously in ancient mythology, but also in contemporary mythology. You know, like if you think of superheroes and all these kind of mutant characters of today, they are very much in this lineage of fantastic characters. No, I don't know what else is in here. Oh well. This is another sort of sculpture project, although it's not like one single sculpture, but a constellation of sculptures, which is guns that I have transformed into musical instruments. And it's basically campaigns that I organize where people bring weapons that then are destroyed and rendered useless and put together, which is a kind of a sort of assemblage technique, you know, like for instance, to do these pieces, I don't have a kind of a drawing or anything in preparation, because it's more about like taking existing parts, like a piece of a AK-47 or a M15, and then like some revolvers maybe come the knobs, etc. And so this one is a cello, which actually recently this famous musician Yo-Yo Ma asked me to perform. So he did a concert in Mexico, and now he's gonna do a concert in Chicago at the Art Institute using this cello, which probably is the worst cello he has ever played, because you're like a
no acoustic problems.
Yeah, I mean, like he's used to very fine
exactly.
instruments, and this is very
it's
clunky.
No Stradivarius, that's
but,
for sure.
Yeah, this is an electric guitar. Mm. And basically, it's also, again, like here, the idea of, even if it's not a sculpture in the kind of a sense that it's like a kind of, I mean, like a lot of times I do sculptures that are only completed when they're used. So they become like kind of agents in a way that that they end up being an element of a larger undertaking. So in this case, for instance, with the issue of gun violence, which is a problem that both Mexico and the United States have to tackle, the goal here is to do sculpture is basically to transform matter, no, to give it a different form, and the hope is that the physical transformation goes together with a psychological transformation, and hopefully a social transformation. So, for instance, like this goes together with a workshop that is called Amendment to the Amendment, where a group of 200, 300 people get together, and we do a workshop where we do kind of small teams of 10 or people, and each team has to come with a new iteration of what they think the Second Amendment should be. And it's about, like, not what is the right interpretation of the Second Amendment, but to rewrite the Second Amendment. So in that way, that is more like a kind of a social sculpture in the idea of having a, this kind of a, at the end of the workshop, you have like 50 different versions that are improvement on the existing Second Amendment. Mm-hmm. And it's basically trying to push the idea, a radical idea, which is that is like, that the law has to change in order to solve the problem of gun violence.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Meg, I want to come back to you because, you know, Pedro uses the word transformation, and I think for me, a lot of your work, particularly the last show at Paul Cooper, you tend to bring the outside in, which I find very, very interesting. So you transform the interior space into a space of an organic space, a space that's growing. So I wanted to ask you, is transformation a word that's interesting to you, or do you describe your work in another way?
I sort of don't think about it that way, but I think I do. I think I'm interested in the material presenting itself and the form presenting itself, and I am interested in the outside inside. I love the pool piece where I brought in a pond inside the PS1, mm-hmm. and also a lot of the objects in that last show were outside materials.
Right.
It's a good thing to ask me why.
Why? I'll follow your lead.
I don't know.
You don't know about it.
No, okay. Yeah.
Well, one thing I also wanted to...
If there was an easy answer, maybe it wouldn't... I don't know.
No.
I don't know if I could... If it had helped for me to say why. But it just is.
Meg, when did you start working with organic materials? I mean, did you go to a kind of more traditional sculpture program or art school?
I started shaping sand on the floor, and they sort of turned into kind of landscapes and concrete forms, like a square or a circle or whatever. And then I made a bed of sand shaped in at my graduate school, and there was a mound of soil, and so it just sort of organically happened, and then I just kept those materials coming and doing that.
Were you in touch with people like Michelle Stewart at that time? I mean, you know, no. So working pretty independently. And
yes.
Did you ever meet like Walter DeMaria or Michael Heiser?
Well, I did actually right after graduate school, I worked with Michael.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
So on and City or on Double
here,
Negative?
No.
Oh, here when he was in New York?
He was when he was in New York.
Okay.
He was doing the animal effigy mounds. And then I went straight into building some sculpture at Don Judd's place, a big rammed earth piece that you walk into and two people are meant to meet and see each other on in this earth and form and then go into this circular hay piece. So it's all about mating in a way, and it's also about mating with the material, being in the material.
Meg, what is your feeling about when you do something outdoors or in the public realm? Does that change your thinking at all in terms of modulating what you do? Is it, you know, obviously in terms of an audience, is there some kind of participatory? I mean, obviously a lot of your work does require
participation,
walking around
it,
for sure, you know, peripatetic kind of, you know, you have to wander.
Yeah.
So is it more just the formal structure of how you get people to move?
It's a combination of the form, which is usually a circle or a square, usually based on a geometric form, and putting you into it, or around it in some cases.
I mean, Pedro, for you, what strategies, I mean, you've done a couple of outdoor projects, and obviously I've curated these two works, which I do want to ask you a couple of questions about, but do you think for, like, Democracy, I mean, did you think about that piece in the totality of the whole space and how people were going to sequence through a series of experiences? You know, what's your thought about doing public sculpture or public art in that way, which would be different from maybe doing like the last show that you had at Listen in New York, you know, which obviously a very kind of formal show, very different kind of experience?
Well, I think that sculpture is such a term that can be extremely wide, mm-hmm. And it can, and I have like one part of my work that deals more with social practice and activated projects, where there's a formal element, but there's an intention that is for the work to have some degree of impact that is either in education or the environment or violence or any some kind of social issues. And then there's like other kind of sculpture. You know, like for me, it took a lot of years to also realize that I can do a sculpture that doesn't need to be anything more than a sculpture. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And also it became a sort of a breakthrough, at least for myself, that to say, okay, well, you know, like I can also do works that are only deal with composition, mm-hmm. And then I started to understand a lot of language of sculpture that is the classical language of sculpture, which is, you know, like
it wasn't your last show, Glyptotech? I mean, it was basically sculpture, exactly. You know, sculpture room in a museum. I mean, I think
It's curious because, you know, like I feel that there was that for instance, like that there's problems that are classical to sculpture, like for instance, like the human figure or things like that, that have been together with humanity forever, and that there was kind of a change in the 60s in the language of sculpture, where, for instance, like figurative sculpture kind of was unfashionable, and then only until the 21st century that kind of hegemony of minimalism has not ended, but you know, like in a way, there's like now not one kind of a main thing, but like anything goes. No, you know, like you can do whatever.
It's much more free, I think. Yes, and the figurative
is
definitely
come. You have a much more diverse range of options to what a sculptor can do. So for me, it was like a kind of a very you know, I have learned to appreciate like certain qualities of sculpture that I didn't like consider before, and then channel like and learn from the past in ways that that I enjoy very much. Mm-hmm. So I have these two bodies of work. Sometimes they merge, but also I have learned that they don't need to merge, right. If they don't
they
have to.
You know,
I can do something that is like very material, and at the same time something that is pure plastic. You know, I don't know if this is a kind of an old-fashioned word, but you know, like the plastic, la
plastic
plastica,
arts. Yeah.
It's like, you know, like these problems about like balance and making a hole through a stone, and then you know, like a reveal, and how the silhouette changes as you walk around an object. I find that endlessly fascinating. You know, mm-hmm. guys, mm-hmm. not all work has to have a function.
Well, you know, for me, I mean, now that I'm at the Noguchi Museum and I sit every day and look down at that garden and walk through the museum, you know, I think the thing that I took to heart and really what Noguchi espoused a lot was the idea that when you put a sculpture down, it changes everything. I mean, it changes the whole environment. So now, you know, at some point in his career, he also moved into an full environmental projects in which he was more interested in not the idea of the single sculpture, but what that sculpture does to the landscape, which then meant that he had to change the landscape, which then meant that each object really had to be holistically placed and somehow, I mean, looking, of course, for a kind of harmony between man and nature in a very maybe utopian, idealistic way. But it brings me, Pedro, just one last thing, because obviously, you know, we actually didn't have direct communication when I was doing the free sculpture, I mean, through the gallery, and obviously I think they relayed information to you, but, you know, I made a very specific decision to place your work in a very specific location. And, you know, I really love those pieces, and I find them to be incredibly strange, and I mean, I really love the idea of people just coming across them. And I thought about many, many places, but I did put them in the lobby of 30 Rockefeller Plaza, mostly because I felt that in a way that they could act as sentinels or witnesses to that Diego Rivera, the removal of that mural. So I just wanted to ask your honest opinion. You know, you've seen it, and you can tell me you hate it. It's fine if that's the case. But just to kind of see, you know, you've gone and how you feel, whether or not the sculptures are successful in that space.
Well, it's funny because, you know, like a I bump into Javier Tellez, who curated this fantastic show of Outsider Art, and he tells me, "Hey, Pedro, you should have put there your portraits of Karl Marx and Lenin, because I had actually like kind of a portrait of Lenin and one of Karl Marx, and it's like a
forgot about those, like, right? Exactly.
It
next
could
time.
Have been like a kind of an interesting kind of a like a
well, Lenin would have been great because obviously that's what killed that mural. I mean, you know,
like it's curious because for instance, like I have a head of Lenin, which is a sort of like a Lenin as a sleeping muse, like the kind of a Brancusi piece. So it's like a Lenin head, like many heads of Lenin that were beheaded from their original
sculptures,
monuments.
Yeah.
And it's reclined as a sort of a sleeping muse, also because it has this kind of egg shape.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, you know, like just I wanted to share with you that.
Well, there's always next year, so we can try it again.
but you know, like I went to see the works installed, and I am very happy with the you know, like the sculpture. The Rockefeller Center is an architectural site that has a lot of sculpture,
mm-hmm.
and that is integral to it. You know, like you have Paul Manship, and
right.
you know,
Dean
like
Cromwell. And there's all
these,
kinds of other things.
All these fantastic glass works, etc. So they definitely feel at home in that kind of deco environment, and also the palette of colors is surprisingly like perfect.
Yes,
you know, like
it is.
Even the stripe like carvings in the walls, etc. So it feels like very, very natural for them to be there. It could be like almost as they're part of the building.
Yeah, a lot of people have been telling me that they actually, I mean, in some ways, the disconcerting thing is that they feel like they've been there all along.
Exactly.
You know, that they've just existed there. And so somehow, but they're so bizarre and strange that when people actually look at them, they kind of have to step back. And I've spent a lot of time now in that lobby over the last week. And I've really enjoyed people kind of getting that moment of recognition of like, oh, this is a tongue coming out of an eyeball, you know, where it's like an eyeball in a mouth. I think, unfortunately, we've probably at this point have to stop. Do we have time for one question, or should we just kind of, does anyone have any questions at all? Okay, why don't we end here, and if you have questions for Meg or Pedro, you can ask as they leave the stage, and thank you all for coming, we appreciate it, and thank you, Matthew, for having us. And
Thank you. Just before you go, I wanted to, before we thank all of our wonderful speakers, and thank you all for being here, do take some water with you, because it's getting warm, you should stay hydrated, and you can find out more about Life Water and its support for emerging artists in the Life Water Lounge, which is just 5 minutes, 3 minutes walk, just out right and a left along the fair further. Please look at Pedro's work at the Booth of Listen, D9. Please watch this space for more exciting news on Meg. I think coming. Am I allowed to talk about you? Am I allowed to talk about you?
Yeah, well, I don't know.
Okay, maybe not. There will be very exciting stuff coming with Meg. And her website is a trove of amazing, both the history of her work, but also unrealized, as yet unrealized proposals for the public realm. It's absolutely fascinating. Please take, if you're going back on the ferry or the bus, a moment to explore Brett Lipman's incredible Frieze sculpture. And please watch this space for more information on the Frieze Life Water Sculpture Prize. And please finally join me in thanking Brett Lipman, Pedro Reyes, and Meg Webster.
I suddenly wanted to announce it, and then I thought, I don't know.
I really, because it just happened.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It's
so fantastic.
I will reach out to you because, you know, I told my archive, and she's looking at me. So she's going to start that.
Selfish.
So I said that. I'm making you a big file. I'll send you it all.
Oh, that'll be.
So we're going to take a look at that.
Super.
Okay.
Super. Thank you.
Yeah,
so
I
much.
Definitely. Because I mentioned it to her, and she was like, "Oh, we have a bet.
That's easy."
Yeah.
That'd
be awesome. Yeah, that'd be
so.
Hi, how are you?
Thank you.
She'll help me get down.